Looks like technology is starting to cooperate, so I will call this committee meeting to order. This is the Wednesday, February 6th, 2013, meeting of the Transportation and Public Safety Committee. A few housekeeping items, members. Folks have been coming to our office after the hearing to ask for additional copies of handouts. We are environmentally conscious. We are purposefully making fewer copies of handouts so we don't have stacks of extras laying around. At the bottom of today's agenda, you'll see a website where we post all handouts. It's the Scribd website, and we've developed a specific site where all handouts are loaded. So you can go out there and get those, load them up to your iPad, or do whatever you like with them there. So take a look at that. We also post that on our committee website, and we also have a committee Twitter feed. So you can go get those there. Members will begin hearing bills next week. On Monday, we have a bill from Senator Senjum and a bill from Senator Fischbach. And then after that, we're going to have what we call Locals Day. We'll hear from MnDOT, the City Trade Association, County and Township Trade Associations. Then Wednesday, we have what we're calling Show and Tell Day. Those are all the community transportation priorities, things like Highway 14. We already have several on the schedule if you'd like yours added or aware of others that maybe we should hear from. These are non-general obligation bonding transportation projects, priorities. You know, they could be, for example, trunk highway funding proposals. Give Michael an email, and we'll get you added. If we get oversubscribed, we'll just go to another day. So with that, members, today we're going to hear a few reports that have been developed in the last year or so that have taken a look at our transportation system, needs, opportunities, challenges, and some suggestions for solutions. The first one, of course, that we've heard a lot about is the TFAC, the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee report that was convened by the governor, chaired by previous Commissioner Sorrell, and then Acting Commissioner Arsenault, and current Commissioner Zelli served on that, as did I. Ken Buckeye is with us, who was the TFAC project manager. And then we're going to hear from the Itasca project, their ROI on transit in the metro area, and then a report that just recently came out called the TRIP report. And we'll hear from Tim Werke from the AGC. With that, welcome to the committee, Commissioner, and Mr. Buckeye.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's an honor to be back in my role as commissioner to present the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee overview and some of the recommendations. And with me is Ken Buckeye, as you have said, who was an active project manager for the committee. Just as a way of a caveat, I did serve on the committee in my former role as both president of Jefferson Lines, but also a co-chair of the Itasca Transportation Initiative. So actually one of the presentations, Jay Coles, will be the now the sole chair of the Transportation Initiative, will be presenting the ROI study. That study was presented to the TFAC committee as part of its deliberations. But just to kind of again qualify the role of MnDOT and my role now in presenting it is this is not the position of MnDOT. It is really the role the agency played in helping facilitate this, you know, process, year-long process, and to really bring facts, figures, and good information from outside the agency as well as from within the agency for this for the committee to consider. So I'm making this presentation. I'm very knowledgeable about it, as is Chairman Dibble, because we were members of the committee, but I'm really acting to present it not as a agency position but as the work of the committee. And just as a quick overview, as you know, it was established over a year ago. It was really appointed by the governor to kind of try to solve or at least get some of the best thinking behind how we would deal with the gradual decline of the of our state's transportation infrastructure, and how to do a little bit of a deep dive into what are the issues in every little mode and what it would require over the next 20 years. So there's a kind of a 20-year time horizon. It wasn't limited to only Minnesota state assets. It was really looking at transportation as a whole, so local, county, regional, and statewide resources. So it was as broad as possible and really as deep as possible to make sure that there was at least a comprehensive view. We considered quality of life. We considered the competitiveness of the system. We considered many different sources of revenue, current and those that are considered by other areas, traditional, non-traditional, and also several presentations on public-private partnerships, what they really offer. And just to give you a flavor, the membership, if you hadn't seen it, are really a pretty broad spectrum. Public sector representatives, public, private sector, different, both Republican and Democrat, House, Senate, county, labor, an economist, and different regions within the state. So I think this group really represented a pretty good cross section of the state and state's transportation expertise. And also, I have to say, you know, speaking as a member of the committee, it was a group that really viewed it as a nonpartisan task. Here, let's try to solve this puzzle. And I thought it really, the committee kind of came together in a very in a really informative and thoughtful way. And this was not, even though it was a year long, but it was many kind of people who gave up a whole day to spend once a month, I think. So it was a fair amount of time, and then a lot of work kind of in between. The governor asked the committee to address three separate scenarios. One is what it would take to fund the status quo. That means the current funding levels. What would that look like? And compare that to maintaining current performance of the existing transportation assets without expansion, without additional mobility, without additional options, just what funding would be required to kind of maintain the system as it is. And then the third, an economically competitive, world-class transportation system. We spent a lot of time talking about what does world-class really mean. In fact, you hear that phrase a lot.
Excuse me.
And there was actually a debate within the committee. Does Minnesota really need to be world-class? What does that mean? I mean, doesn't that sound really expensive? And we just want to be Minnesota. We don't need to be Singapore. Well, I think, just to pick a city, we kind of came down to the idea that what the governor is asking is what is it to be economically competitive with those regions, those cities, those states that might draw businesses, citizens? What is it to be kind of in the game to be a world-class state? So what's a world-class, what's it a competitive, economically competitive transportation system to help support the world-class state of Minnesota that we all, aspire for? So we received testimony from a number of stakeholders, really kind of opened it up to those that wanted to make a presentation. We allowed time for at every meeting for kind of testimony and information. We did additional customer outreach. We have a website which both offered information as well as gathered input. And we had 9 open houses around the state. So MnDOT, I think, did an excellent job. I'll say that because I was an outsider then. In gathering as much support or interest and in input as possible, both online and in person. So here are the things that were, here's the issues and the trends that we really looked at. Both the size of the system, the aging infrastructure, what were the costs of congestion. We looked at the safety, and there's an economic issue behind safety as well, not only kind of being the right thing. We considered energy costs. Certainly construction inflation was a major consideration given we're in a period of fairly low inflation, but that's not always been the case. And the growing globalization of our economy, knowing that some of our members on the committee represented large global businesses who looked at transportation costs of shipping products as being a major consideration for where they had plants, where they had offices. And then, really, where is the changing dynamics of our population? The new normal, what is it going to be? Because these are generational investments. You can't, you know, as the line, the Wayne Gretzky, you want to go where the puck's heading, not to where it was. And so where is the trends, the values, the system to accommodate the next generation? So just a couple of quick slides that will kind of show some of the gnarly issues I think we were facing. I think this slide says it maybe best. When we have existing revenue resources facing increased construction costs, the purchasing power of that revenue combined with maybe more fuel efficiency from cars, there is a widening gap from what it takes to build projects, maintain assets, compared to the existing revenue sources. So that gap is kind of best exemplified by this slide. You can see in 20 years, it's significant. So in doing what is basically, you know, and this is a summary, the arithmetic, we kind of determined, and this is, as they say, the money slide. This is really showing the three different scenarios. Existing resources, again, is scenario one. So there's no gap because we're living within whatever is available. And scenario two, where's the gap between existing sources of revenue and what it will take to maintain the system, to keep the performance where it is today, which in some way I'd argue there's areas in the state where performance is subpar, but let's just say this is the starting point. This is the gap of as much as $21 billion in all these areas that is the 20-year gap. And again, you'll see that an annual fund gap is in red, and then the total is in the blue. And then scenario three, what would it take to enhance the mobility, preserve the assets, and to be this economically competitive system in our best judgment? Again, in the different areas, some of it, MnDOT, many of it, metropolitan, regional, county, local, and the airports. And that's where our $50 billion gap, if you look at it in its entirety, $50 to $55 billion, is really, over a 20-year period, the gap from current funding.
And, Commissioner, I'll just note for the committee's benefit, at one time, this is an interesting number, this $50 billion to $54 billion is an interesting number, because at one time, a few years ago, MnDOT had put out this number just for the roadway system. So it really was the measuring stick. So this is everything. This is transit, ports, roads, bridges, et cetera, local and state facilities, roads. The measuring stick was taken out, and there was a recalibration. So this isn't like some gargantuan number that's pie in the sky that get been pulled out of the air that's bigger than anything else we've ever seen before. This is actually a fairly sharp analysis that the committee had the benefit of delving into.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that's right. I mean, in fact, I think these numbers, I hate to overuse the word conservative, but it was a very thoughtful that this was not just, again, a pie-in-the-sky number. We can kind of drill deeper into each one of these areas, and it does kind of list and ground it in some fairly solid arithmetic. So when you have a committee that represents a wide range geographically, politically, background, and kind of comes together and say, yeah, we think these are reasonable projections.
Thank you.
So that conclusions about the system, and this is from our conversations and from the facts and from looking at other regions, realizing that even though we've listed them all by mode, they are very interlinked and a critical component in our state's economy. Clearly, funding is facing not just declining purchasing power, but actual declining revenues, given the increased fuel economy of cars and actually maybe even reduced vehicle miles traveled in some areas. To maintain the competitive advantage, there was wide, unanimous belief that additional revenue will be needed. And along with that, there was certainly an emphasis that new technology, more best practices, efficiency could be pursued and should be and is kind of in these numbers to gain greater advantage with existing resources. So it wasn't just a revenue solution. We did really look thoughtfully about how both to mitigate risk as well as to have the investments be kind of most impactful. We spend a lot of time talking about return on investment, and I know you'll hear from Mr. Coles later, but the return on investment, having high impact, high return investments, was a theme for every mode, that actually there's a return on investment for a road, a bridge, transit, all investments should be considered as ones that have some economic benefit, either direct, as in kind of, making sure it's, if you look at a lifespan of an asset, how it's built should be considered for the life cycle cost, not just, do it on the cheap, it gets more expensive later. So there was a comprehensive view of return on investment. And then we looked at ways, and one of the values that we felt was important was that any funding gap, the investment framework should be sustainable, equitable, sustainable meaning not sometimes one-time fixes, debt that precludes future debt capacity for additional projects later, that we should look at ways to sustain a system over 20 years without kind of reaching the metaphorical brick walls of funding conundrums. And we really kept a lot of time, and this was not just the business folks in the room saying that infrastructure, transportation corridors all had really critical economic competitiveness value, that the benefit as a whole and in particular corridors was really essential for maintaining the prosperity, the economic prosperity of our state. It was not just about getting people to work or to school, but a lot about shipping, both rail and highway and water, that and air. I mean, there's a testimony from businesses who could speak to the costs of congestion, even though their plants were in North Branch or in Wilmer.
Thank you, Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Zelli, I'm sorry I stepped out of the room. Maybe this was answered. In talking about your conclusions, did you factor in opportunity cost, as in if you made investments in one portion that you were losing opportunities to make major investments in other portions of the transportation system, whether it's metro versus rural, whether it's light rail versus freeway? Did those factor into those conclusions and those discussions?
Well, I think philosophically, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator, we did, as a whole, consider the idea of a high return investments was to say that the investments taken in the state as a whole should be ones that are most impactful. So if you invest here, by taking those funds and not investing in another place was certainly considered, but not there wasn't we didn't look at it to say we only have limited amount of funds, so we have to make choices, which is kind of where we are now. We looked at what are all the investments to be at that same level.
Mr. Chair, so Senator. Just your last statement, I just want to restate that. So what you took what you said was basically your premise was is that you didn't come at it necessarily with a some of these conclusions with a realistic pot of money saying you have only this much to work with, that you had finite resources. It was much more pie in the sky, we'd like to do it if we had a chance to do it type of scenario. Is that fair? Is that a fair restatement of what you just said?
Well, I,
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Senator, it was probably somewhere in between what you just said. It wasn't pie in the sky. It was just say what would be the investment required to be at that kind of economically competitive level for all modes, not what would it what would be available if we could do anything. That number would be considerably bigger. I mean, it was to say here would be a responsible investment in all modes, which are interlinked, in order in all areas to be at that kind of competitive level. And competitive level meaning if you look at some of the other city, regions, states, what is being done in other areas, not just in the United States, but in other kind of regions in the world, to be kind of competitive, to have a competitive transportation system, what would that look like? And here's our best estimate as to what that investment would be in the entire state.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. To follow up on that a little bit, you know, I noticed in the minority opinion they expressed that there would be a desire to keep this type of transportation funding neutral in the overall budget. So right. Is it safe to say, even though they expressed that opinion, that really wasn't in the work of the TFAC group trying to keep it neutral really wasn't part of your charge, so to speak, as a committee from the governor?
No, we did not consider, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator, we did not consider taxes in areas outside of transportation. And that member who wrote the letter with the entire committee's blessing, I think highlighted that these recommendations are worthwhile and supported. But there was another context to say with when you seek additional revenue, perhaps the entire cost of taxes burdens on private businesses in particular should be considered. So that person's position was, I think these are solid investments. I'm very much for them. I like the entire kind of way of thinking toward high return investments throughout those modes. But we should consider a larger context within the state. So it was not that member didn't believe that these weren't worthwhile investments, and he kind of said, "Yes, I think they are."
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Zelli, and I think the other thing I would add that I recall from that opinion was the desire to make sure that those funding sources remain fair. And if I think the example they used was the gas tax and how that would unfairly impact communities in greater Minnesota because it costs just the transportation costs to get fuel to those communities to start with to sell at a wholesale or retail level costs more. And then it would have a greater impact. A fuel tax, for example, would have a greater impact negatively in greater Minnesota communities because of that. I think is that an accurate statement of the other point in that minority? Well, actually, everybody can read that. They can read that minority opinion for themselves. So, but that's what I recall. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, I think that we had a conversation when his minority letter came and it was actually embraced, but he reiterated a number of times that I am not trying to move away from these recommendations, which as a whole he viewed as sustainable, fair, all the other values that we had come together on. I think he felt it was appropriate. His only point was as a representing that company, I would like a larger view at least considered toward the entire cost of two businesses in central Minnesota.
Thank you.
Commissioner.
Again, these are the financing principles that some of which I've just referred to that helped inform are thinking of these recommendations: high return on investment, economic efficiency, job growth, transparency, quality of life, equitable, strategic, and then, of course, balancing market and public roles. There is a, particularly when we have an economist from the Federal Reserve and folks from the financial industry who says, you know what, markets are very powerful force, not just for getting the lowest cost and efficiency, but also for helping direct traffic flows. For instance, the MnPass system is really one that allows the market to help regulate traffic. So a broad concept of that market forces are a good thing to help gain efficiency. And then reliable and sustainable, again, we talked about sustainable in terms of funding, but also reliable just in terms of the asset values itself. We do want to have a pie in the sky, leading edge technology, ones that was that is realistic, it's doable, and didn't put the state resources at risk.
And Commissioner, I'll just add, I think Art Rolnick did a nice job of taking the entire committee to school around these ideas about economic efficiency, return on investment, balancing market and public roles. The one discussion I recall distinctly was, you know, pointing out that, you know, every dollar you spend publicly is a dollar you're taking out of the private sector, so you had better be pretty sure that that dollar being spent by the public sector is being spent more efficiently than it would be spent in the private sector, and you really need to ask that every time you take that dollar out of the private sector. I mean, there are things that the private sector absolutely can do that we should take advantage of and harness. I mean, that's where the whole PPP discussion comes up. But it's also around you know, the fact that we're not each of us going to construct our own road to our front doorstep. That's not efficient. You know, and so we weigh those factors as we examine the kinds of public services that we choose to purchase and then how we choose to purchase those. That was really interesting.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, for mentioning that. I call him Professor Rolnick. It's Art Rolnick, formerly from the Fed, now with the University of Minnesota, really did spend some time with, as kind of a lecture in a PowerPoint, giving a common language and a framework for the committee to consider. And as the chairman has pointed out, this public sector investments in transportation has been a really a traditional area for the public's resources to be invested. And he kind of described where those where the gray areas are, and also said, unlike the private sector, the public sector can build capacity in advance of the actual use. So sometimes he says these are 30-year investments. Aren't always measured by the actual current return in year one, but to look ahead at where the trends are, because they are so large and the part of the public space, the common area, that those investments made sense and help support an economy. So.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, in taking a look at this, I think one of the there are two points I think Mr. Rolnick made some good ones as well. But when I read in here about Minnesota already ranks near the top of all states in key tax categories, so while we strive to be competitive by having this world-class situation, and maybe in that regard that might help you to be competitive, on the other hand, if you worsen those standings, you make yourself uncompetitive in another area. So you've kind of traded off your things. And I think also if these revenue increases were in isolation, it's one thing. But when you add to them the other income tax raises, the other fee increases, the other things that are going on right now, the substantial uncompetitive nature of what you do to the people, all of those things put together really make this very difficult. But if this is all you had, it's one thing to absorb that in the private sector, but this added on to with all the other things, plus the fact that we're there, it's one thing if we were number 47 and we had room to maybe work on that, but that's a concern. We're trading one area for another, And I don't know that in the end we're going to be ahead.
Well, I'll take a first. That was a Senator Kiffmeyer's an excellent point, and of course that's our job now, of course, as legislators, to balance all, you know, the entire set of issues that are in front of the legislature. You know, there was quite a bit of examination, and we'll hear, of course, the return on investment as it relates to transit investments in the metro area. There is an analysis that's a part of the TFAC report around a failure to act, the opportunity cost, not trading modes against off each other inside the state itself, but you know, what happens if we don't act, and the opportunity cost that presents. I mean, there's real costs in terms of congestion. Those are fairly easy to measure. Time spent in our cars away from our family, the inability for workers and employers to access each other, the failure to get goods and services to market in an efficient way, but also the fact that businesses will just simply locate elsewhere if they see a congested metropolitan area with no transit service and, you know, the corresponding land use that spurs, and interregional corridors that are, you know, cow paths to nowhere with, you know, without the farm to market, you know, so there's real costs that we can attribute to failure to act, and that's the argument. I understand what you're saying, and everything needs to be considered in context. Absolutely, you're right on that point, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator. I think we, as a committee, we're looking at how you tie the investments to value. And you're right; it was not considering the larger framework of costs of say business or to citizens, but to look at this particular area of transportation and how do you tie the invested dollars or the revenue sources to the value received for the economy and for citizens. I think it's important to note that when you look at the benchmarking of where Minnesota is on, say, the fuel tax, that's at one point in time. We had presentations from ASHTO, which is the Association of State Highway Officials, and they made a number of recommendations, one of which is that one of which is that every state is having this conversation. And there's TFACs in Wisconsin and our neighbors. Wisconsin that's already has a higher gas tax than we do. And so even though that benchmark, that ranking is where it is today in 2012, last year, I think over the next 20 years it is likely, given the need for infrastructure and the pressure on states to invest, that will evolve and likely not always gas tax. I think there's a lot of different financing sources and ideas being discussed in many states. Their legislators are meeting just as you are, trying to consider the alternatives.
Great. Thank you.
The recommendations for additional revenue was to embrace the efficiency, high return on investment approach, to pursue innovations, to make sure that was, again, value associated with any investment. But we looked at four general areas. One, a system-wide approach for roads, transit, looking at dedicated sales tax options, again, looking at expanding the local government options, again, as to how local governments might be able to address their transportation needs. And then also, again, at the project level, this is what mechanisms are available for a specific project. And in all cases, we looked at what other states are doing and what is both efficient and available. In the area of roads, we did look at not just motor fuels tax, but also registration fees. There are, of course, three major funding sources that go into the Trunk Highway Fund: registration fees, MVEST, and the excise tax on motor fuels. So, as you know, that these funds are divided by in the state constitution through a formula. So the outcomes achieved is not 100% target in each one of these categories, but it certainly gets us to what we believe is more competitive. There is pressure, and that was part of the belief that the committee, just as we've discussed, needs to not just be pie in the sky, but to really have an incentive to drive toward greater efficiency and to look at every investment being impactful. It isn't a wish list, so it does create pressure on all layers of government to do the best they can with what they receive. The transit dedicated sales tax recommendation considers how we measure with other metropolitan areas in particular. With the raising the sales tax for transit, but also we looked at capturing the remaining leased vehicle tax that is currently going to the general fund. We thought that since it's a transportation source, it should be dedicated to transportation, and that amount being kind of equal to an allocation for Greater Minnesota Transit, that it is kind of it is underfunded, and get it more close to the goals. Again, this gets 95% of the target met for the metro area and 71% of the revenue gap for Greater Minnesota. Again, not 100%.
For the local, if I could pause on that.
Sure.
This motor vehicle lease tax, MVLT, as a contrast with MVST, MVEST, was not captured via the constitutional amendment. Some thought it was. Turns out it wasn't. Because this is really the sales tax that's paid on long-term lease for vehicles. It has been used for all kinds of other things to the consternation of folks who really believe that in the spirit of what the people of Minnesota said by virtue of that constitutional amendment, those dollars should be coming to transportation purposes. It is a shared goal among many in the legislature to return those dollars to transportation purposes. Of course, they go into the general fund now, so it creates a general fund issue that we would need to address, but I just wanted to highlight that subject.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, that was, I think, thought by many to have been included in the constitutional amendment in MVEST, but it was not.
Right. Oh, and I just also want to mention, because it came up in my last committee, Economic Development Finance, there is something called the car rental tax. That's something different. That's a tax that's paid on short-term rental of cars. There is a proposal in front of the legislature, part of the governor's budget, at 6.2% now to raise it to 9-point-something. It would go into the general fund, but the idea is to fund tourism purposes, the Explore Minnesota, the former Department of Tourism. You know, you could argue that's a transportation source, but it's also, that's paid by tourists who come here, so there's some nexus for that proposed additional tax and its proposed use. So I feel as anxious about that as I do about the MVLT. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is right. That is not included in this in this area.
Right.
And the local government revenue options is kind of a list of a number of areas, again, that we think could provide greater flexibility at the local level. Wheelage tax for 80 counties. Really kind of enabling legislation that would provide for innovative financing that we've seen in other states, such as providing improvement districts. The idea of actually enabling local communities to have their own sales taxes to expand their transit or their transportation investments. We think that this kind of is in the spirit of local determination provides greater equity in terms of those being able to have the options that was most appropriate for any particular jurisdiction. And then project-level revenue options is really some of the tools that many areas are doing that we think we have in a limited extent in Minnesota, but we could expand. We look favorably on the MinPass system as a way to manage passenger miles within the existing, capacity. This is a way to drive more free-flowing traffic through congested areas, and it seems to have worked. We now have two great pilots, and our analysis shows that it's effective. We ought to be pursuing that because it's not just what it costs to have a MinPass system. It's just that versus an additional lane is quite a substantial. So it's that opportunity cost consideration. We think value capture is a very important and could be a useful tool, particularly linked up with some federal opportunities. Value capture is to take the increased value of real estate generally or our development project, most closely associated with transit hubs, but it could be roads as well or bridges. But it's the idea of actually thinking out of the box and providing some of the value that accrues to adjacent areas to have some of that go to help fund the actual project. So it's one of the important tools in the toolbox. We didn't, as a committee, say it works best here, it works least well there, but we said we should be exploring, at least allowing that to be pursued for the appropriate use. Again, flexibility. Certainly, public-private partnerships, monetizing assets, and up to and including tolling ought to be an option and be explored. We know that there's very expensive, large projects that are new. We ought to be open to the possibility of capturing some of the revenue that's coming over a bridge or a particular project. Continuing the general obligation bonding for local roads has been really important for the state in the past. We think that ought to be continued. It by itself doesn't answer the whole question, but it should still be on the table, and it has, for every bonding bill, really been essential, particularly for those areas that don't have access to the traditional trunk highway funding. Again, this is a way to leverage funds. It enhances options. We think that generally flexibility and options for different levels of government is a good thing. It can react to the market. It can react to a particular need. And that we can recommend to the state in terms of policy to have those as something that should be considered. Again, under challenges, and we discussed.
Senator Pat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Zelli, I'm kind of curious about the concept of monetizing assets. Can you talk about that and how maybe some explanation? It's not clicking with me.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chairman. Senator, I didn't mean to glibly go over that. But roads and bridges or systems have, in some other states, had the ability to work with private sector investors or operators in order to raise the funds required to build or even maintain an asset, a bridge, a transit system, a station, a road. And generally, there has to be a revenue source. So firms don't come in and build these assets for nothing. So the asset revenue, the revenue base could be tolling. Chicago actually dedicated parking meters. There could be it could be rent, which is kind of a value capture from a private sector joint venture development. But a monetizing is really taking the revenue stream associated with an asset. And then essentially the private sector provides both equity and debt financing to help build the project. So monetizing is really taking that revenue stream and leveraging against that to provide the funding. Therefore, a local jurisdiction or a county or the state doesn't need to actually bond from our other resources to build that. It's generally associated with tolling or some other kind of value capture instrument.
But, Commissioner, I don't recall when I see monetizing the word privatizing or selling a public transportation facility pops into my head, and I don't recall that idea actually being discussed.
No, and in fact, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that we heard some horror stories. One thing we learned is in these public-private partnerships are really excellent in terms of mitigating risk of getting of things built by taking a current debt capacity, dealing with current debt capacity issues, but it doesn't. But selling a road to some private entity where there'd be no public oversight was deemed as being, you know, not in the best interest of the public sector or the citizens. So, you know, there's a balance there. It's appropriate in certain ways, but just saying, here's the bridge, do with it what you like, was not considered feasible and or recommended or even worthwhile.
Thank you. Senator Osmick.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Zelli, at one slide back, you talked about local option sales tax with or without a referendum. Sounds like without a referendum is something that's currently being thought of. I'm confused as to why that would be necessary, considering local option or local or forms of government already have the ability to float GO bonds of their own without having a referendum and assess their constituency for those bonds. We've in my city for the past 10 years, we have rebuilt streets and rebuilt water systems and built a parking ramp, and we've done it all with general obligation bonds, or in some cases gone through our Housing and Redevelopment Authority, which conveniently is also city council members, to float these bonds, as well as build a fire department. So I guess I'm sort of confused the need for that type of additional taxing authority and why local jurisdictions wouldn't just use their current existing authority in order to get those projects done.
Well,
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm not a tax expert. I'm a simple bus guy. But my understanding is that some of those current instruments really put more pressure on property taxes, which is the way those bonds are repaid. And this sales tax offers another tool for a more kind of stable revenue source, which if you're, you know, have a lot of tourist activity, maybe there's a way to put the pressure off of local residents and onto visitors to help fund some of the assets that are being enjoyed by tourists. I mean, as an example. So I think it's just offering it, wouldn't force it. It just simply is something that might work in some communities, not others. It certainly wouldn't take away the opportunity to do general obligation bonds that are paid by the residents.
Okay, thank you.
And we'll hear Senator Osmick more from the locals on Monday, and I'm pretty sure they're going to raise this subject. Senator Gimsey and Representative Beard, actually, this was a part of a proposal they brought forward, these transportation improvement districts, ability to generate some new sources of dollars. And there actually is authority with referendum that was a part of the 2008 bill. That's been a fairly big constraint. You can have that philosophical discussion about whether or not the referendum is advisable or not, but to date it's prevented the ability to raise sales tax in other counties outside of the metropolitan area for transportation purposes. Well, thank you. Commissioner.
Thank you. As we discussed, there were challenges. As we talked about, one TFAC member did not endorse higher taxes without considering, again, the larger context of the state burden. Also, you know, we just noted using our online community, this is really from MnDOT, that that our citizens really aren't aware of how complicated the matrix of transportation funding is. I mean, this is just the overview, and you all may have access to the full report, but it is a complicated structure. If you consider local regional, county, state, federal funding, and it is not widely understood. For instance, folks may think that roads are not subsidized, but of course they are from various jurisdictions. And so we kind of thought there really is, a need for more clarity, more education. How is it supported? I think this value proposition would be more, at least in our opinion, more politically feasible if it was better understood. So I'm just going to, one of the charges to the committee was to consider how do we get the message out to citizens and provide various tools. This is just some examples. So I will just show you briefly without reading through each slide. But as you have before you, it really shows adequate funding has true benefits. Without funding, it's going to impact everybody in the state. And in my limited role here as transportation commissioner, and I was meeting with folks from Bemidji a half hour ago, I mean, every community has a story, which I'm sure you all know. So I think we're trying to tie that individual stories to what this larger recommendation offers. So the next steps have occurred. The report was given to Governor Dayton. He has really asked that this be a report not just to him, but to the citizens of Minnesota, and that we will share this report with you, and that we have already presented to the House Committee on Transportation. We want to start a dialogue. We have had offers from a number of our committee members. If they're in town and available, they would be happy to speak at forums, including the legislature, to give them their personal views. So I'm just kind of representing them generally, but they're happy, whether it be, Art Rolnick or some of the representatives from private industry have expressed a willingness to come and express their own views. I think this is just some ideas for trying to, again, how do we explain the transportation system in a few slides, and it's hard to do. But I think it shocks folks to know that this is 140,000 miles of highway, 20,000 bridges, 9 shipping ports, nearly 5,000 of freight tracks. So it's, we want to embark on a way, and that's one of the roles I view as commissioner I can do, is to help explain our system to our citizens.
Does this include local roads and local bridges? The miles and the count?
It's the entire system.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
The next slide really is tying this infrastructure to our growth. To make a direct connection, which we believe there is, between the state's prosperity and this investment in transportation infrastructure.
I think I said it at the last time you presented, we're not going to be able to afford helicopters for everyone. It's just not going to happen.
But there was recommendations for personal helicopters for legislators, but I don't know.
That's a different subject.
And again, it's a whole state issue. I think we really looked at this, that each region is unique, but there's a common theme, and really there are challenges in every area. And this is a graphic, just kind of one of our final graphics, is just to show how this transportation infrastructure is very much connected to when you are considering health, education, entertainment, some of the important lifestyles of our citizens. They may not like the idea we're talking about transportation finance, but everybody uses it every day. So this just is our communication goals. This is what we really are embarking on, not just during the session, but we'll continue to try to do a better job explaining what is in our transportation system and some of the challenges that we all face as citizens when we recognize that it's one state and what we need to address going forward. So having that, we stand ready to answer questions. I will probably point to Ken for anything that's at all complicated, but I'm happy to.
Great. Thank you. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Zelli, so certainly we have a wide range of financing options. I guess one of the questions I would have, certainly the comments come up, we do have limited resources, even with options. How is MnDOT using this report in light of the governor accepting and maybe not proposing some of the recommendations coming out of it? And how will we know the prioritization of certain projects as we look to allocate funds as well?
Commissioner.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, two things. One is I know the governor has not recommended more taxes on the road system, and he has said, I believe that's not a politically, popular idea. But I think he has been pretty clear about the importance about infrastructure investments are to our economy. So he has certainly tasked me with telling this story to say, look, if there's a need, and an arithmetic as to what we see coming in, please, go to Bemidji and tell the story. So I take that seriously. And he has said, look, let's just have this debate. Let's have this conversation. Let's make sure that it's tied to actual districts who have a need. So he would like to see that conversation happening. And I've not been told, no, the only thing that he would ever support is just that budget. He wants to have that as a starting point, and he's tasked us to help tell the story of the committee's findings and then others. So so we're doing that. I think that in terms of how we prioritize within MnDOT, now just representing MnDOT, I think that there is a process of how we put plans together and how we prioritize based upon high impactful investments that is taking what is resources we have to do a good job. We try to take care of the road condition. I think our Better Roads program has really been effective at saying, look, you know what, we don't want to just work for a couple of years, but we need to take care of the system we have. That when we expand a system, we are creating the future requirement to maintain that system. So we're trying to be thoughtful about how you prioritize and do it and do a good job, knowing that it's a regional balance throughout the whole state. We know that there's more needs that we have the capacity to deliver, but how we tie in specific investments to an economic impact, we're going to try to do a more careful job at being more transparent about where those results come from. But that's a work in process, and I think the staff has done a kind of good job at this point, and I'm hoping we can get greater clarity and transparency on that process.
And Senator Pratt, I'm committed to that as well, understanding better. This is, mine and Senator Sendham's project, the where it all happens question, how the STIP is developed, and then how we prioritize or how we create the priority order of the list. But, we're going to have to confront the fact that stuff isn't going to happen. I mean, there are significant needs that simply aren't going to happen absent resources. That's just a fact. Unless we can create the political space and the political will for that to occur.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, I would also say that we do some view of needs based upon looking in the rearview mirror of, congestion, traffic counts, but to look forward to say, here are some opportunities for additional commerce. Here's some opportunities for growth in our state. Here's where we think populations might be leading. These are opportunities, I think, for being smart about future investments, not just reactive. And with limited resources, you become very reactive. And I think we need to be thinking openly about where our state's going. And that's at least an opportunity, I think, for us to keep working on that.
Great, thank you. Any other questions, committee? Great. Well, thank you very much, Commissioner. Appreciate your time. Members, you have the full report. I'm sure you saw that.
Thank you.
Not too terrible to read. Pretty good report, I think. I was, have a little pride of authorship here. So I would recommend you glance at it. If nothing else, there's a nice summary at the front that's just a few pages long. But the content of the report is actually pretty interesting. The metrics and the analysis is actually pretty interesting. So it's a good read. You can slip it under your pillow tonight and absorb
again,
it through osmosis. Commissioner.
Chairman, if anybody and all members of the committee would like any additional information, we're at MnDOT or myself would be happy to provide and follow up with you individually about any thoughts or questions you have about your district or the state or the report.
Great. Thank you very much. All right. We're going to pause for 30 seconds. We have a little technology switch out, but I think everything is in good order. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I remember that in one of our first days of our hearings, mm-hmm. we turned in some sheets on
yes.
interests.
Yes.
There are a couple of them I think I haven't seen yet,
right.
maybe.
Right.
We're still going to get to that?
Yeah, oh, yeah. So the plan is we're actually the bills are kind of coming in slowly. And, you know, so get busy with the revisers. So the plan is, Senator, next week when we start hearing bills, we'll hear a couple of bills and take an opportunity to maybe have a little education. We won't necessarily go every day till 5:30, but we'll take the opportunity to start working through that list, have little educational nuggets, and deal with everyone's questions.
Seeing anything come up, so I'm going to restart this.
So next up, we will have the Itasca Project Regional Transit System Return on Investment Assessment, which looks like this.
Okay, not just me.
And then there's the summary report as well in your packet. I guess.
Excuse me, Chair Dibble.
Mr. Coles.
While we continue to work
right.
with our technology, I apologize to the committee and the committee members. I believe you have a copy of the PowerPoint presentation that I intended to go through in full living color. I'll provide the color in my remarks if we're unable to get this up on
Very
the screen.
Very good. All right. Well, don't be too colorful. This is the Senate.
Noted.
You can do that in the House.
My name is Jay Coles. I am president of Unity Avenue Associates, which is a family office located in Minneapolis. And I am here today as a volunteer member of the Itasca Project. As the commissioner described earlier in his remarks, he and I have been acting for 10 years as co-chairs of a priority of the Itasca Project, and I'll go into that in just a moment. If you turn to the second page in your handout labeled Itasca Project Introduction, just want to take a moment to introduce the organization. We're an employer-led metro regional civic alliance focused on building a thriving economy and quality of life in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan region, with an additional emphasis on reducing and eliminating socioeconomic disparities within the region. We're made up at any given moment of roughly about 50 or so participants. We are led by private sector CEOs. Our original CEO 10 years ago, chair, was Jim Campbell of Wells Fargo. Mary Brainerd of Health Partners succeeded him and has led up until very recently when Richard Davis, the CEO of U.S. Bank, assumed the chairmanship of Itasca. But in addition to the private sector leadership that drives our agenda, we include public sector leaders, as you can see, the governor's office or the governor himself, the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul, the chairs of the Metropolitan Council, leaders of the University of Minnesota and MinSCU as examples, and also leaders of several of our major foundations in the United Way. If you turn to the next page, you'll see the priorities of Itasca Project. You'll note the goals of Itasca in the middle of the triangle, the middle of the pyramid, intended to suggest that in all of our priorities, we are attempting to achieve the goals that I outlined a moment ago. Generating high-quality job growth has risen to be a priority in the last few years. Improving our region's education system has been a longstanding priority of Itasca. And then in the lower left corner, advancing a comprehensive and aligned transportation system, in fact, is probably the oldest priority, or I should say it's one of the very original priorities of Itasca Project when it began. When our participants began to look at the metro region and discuss strategic priorities for the region 10 years ago,
Tom, just go ahead.
Transportation rose to the surface as one of our priorities.
Go ahead.
For the following reasons, and we've heard this echoed in comments over the 10 years, but I would also refer to Michael Langley and the greater MSP economic development effort, which has launched in the last 2 years. He will tell you, as we observed ourselves, that one of the top criteria for evaluating business growth and expansion in the region is transportation. The first priority is workforce and human capital, but the second criteria that we often hear from site selectors who are looking for opportunities to expand or relocate, or from people, businesses here in town who are evaluating whether or not to continue to expand their businesses here in this market, transportation is a priority. And there's a few key reasons, and I just wanted to review those, even though they're not in your presentation. First of all, transportation allows an efficient movement of goods. And despite the fact that we are now increasingly a service economy, the fact is we rely on the movement of goods for the efficiency and effectiveness of our business organizations. Transportation connects employers to the workforce and enables employees to access employment in other destinations. And you'll hear in just a moment how I think the return on investment from the transit system being completed, in fact, acts very directly on that. It provides an ability to access destinations through multiple modes of transportation, and that influences where people choose to live. This is not directly a part of my report, but obviously being able to retain and attract talent to this region is a critical condition of future economic growth. And finally, long-term infrastructure planning shapes investment patterns, and that includes housing, includes civic structures such as hospitals, education, and so forth. It's a very crucial part of evaluating the opportunity that any region offers to businesses. Let me describe the transit ROI study, and so I'll hold up the page that I'm going to begin with here. Itasca likes to bring research and facts to its discussions, and a couple of years ago, we assembled a task force of business leaders in the region and said, what could we do uniquely that we thought would advance the conversation about the merits and the value of investing further to create a comprehensive multimodal transportation system? And we arrived at the conclusion that, as business people, a very familiar analysis of return on investment might, in fact, be useful in this case, where, as with businesses that are looking at large capital investments, they will try to identify what the cost of that capital investment is. They'll also want to identify the cost of continuing to operate and maintain that new asset. And in turn, over a period of time, in our case about 30 years of analysis, they want to understand what advantages will accrue to me, what financial advantages will accrue to me for having made that investment. And so we thought, let's see if we can find the very best research and thinkers on this subject in the field of transportation. We selected Cambridge Systematics, which I think is a familiar firm, as I understand it, with a number of the policy discussions here in this state. And we also established a local technical advisory committee, and that is also at the very back of your presentation today. It is a list of people to assist us in making the correct assumptions, because as you can imagine, with any calculation like this, the results vary depending upon what kind of assumptions you make, and we wanted to make sure we had the best thinking of our, not just a national outside consultant, but our local experts. We asked three questions about regional transit investments. Obviously, it would cost a great deal. What would be the return? And we used as our base case the Metropolitan Council's 2030 plan with a scenario of building it out by the year 2030. And then we ran our projections out to the year 2045, which was essentially the edge of what I think the Met Council felt that they could reasonably project to in terms of population growth and so forth. We asked a second question, which is, if this is an attractive investment, would there in fact be value in investing more quickly in realizing the benefits from this build out sooner? And how would that affect the returns out through the year 2045? And then finally, by observation, we know that many communities that have developed or are developing transit systems experience that their relative regional growth, that the regional growth tends to bend rather than being smoothly spread around the region, tends to bend towards the locations of the transit, the major transit hubs. And if we experienced a kind of bending in what we were assuming for our regional economic development patterns, would the fact that jobs and economic development were being located near these transit hubs, would that in fact change the return on investment? So we looked at four scenarios. The base case is simply where we are today, which is the completion of Central Corridor, but no expectation of any additional light rail or bus rapid transit arterial lines. And then we looked at the three scenarios. One is the 2030 plan with three new LRT lines, four completed BRT corridors, and nine arterial BRTs. I want to be clear that we were not prescriptive in identifying precisely the routes and locations of these. That's the Met Council and future decision makers as the investment is made. But it is a description of the level of capacity and volumes and the experience from this consulting firm and the Metropolitan Council's own data on our region that was utilized in our overall projection of what a build-out system would look like and operate like. We'll look at a map in just a moment. The second scenario, what happens if we built that out in 10 years rather than 17 years? Very ambitious. We're not testing in our, we're not proving by asserting this that in fact it could be accomplished practically. But we also know that there is value associated with time, particularly in long-term projects where you're attempting to anticipate future patterns. And then finally, if in fact we observe the kind of bending of growth clustering to major transit stations and hubs, as we've seen in other regions, how might that affect our scenario as well? If you look at the next page, there's a very familiar map to you. This is the 2030 regional transit system as imagined at this point. And while we tend to focus on the LRT lines, I want to emphasize that this includes even more mileage being dedicated to BRT, both bus rapid transit as well as arterial bus rapid transit and bus lines in order to connect the various transit lines and go beyond simply a hub-and-spoke system. We calculated six kinds of direct impacts, and we asked that these be rooted in confident research on the part of the consultants. These, I think, you can very quickly imagine in your mind. Vehicle operating costs, obviously, for people who are not driving automobiles, who are now transit riders, there is a significant reduction, obviously, in their expense operating and owning a car. Maybe they use transit some of the time and a car some of the time, but the costs go down. But included in this figure is also the experience of all those who continue to use cars, whether sometimes or all the time, through this period of time, 2045. The fact is, if you are able to bring significant transit corridors into being, you will, in fact, enhance the efficiency of your entire road and highway system, especially at the times of the commuter traffic, which is, what is it, 2 or 3 hours now in the morning and several hours in the afternoon. But during those periods of times of congestion, you make a marked impact on the ability of the road system to remain relatively uncongested. And this is a very important figure, particularly in light of the additional population growth that we that the Met Council is projecting of 900,000 new residents within the next 17 years. Then these other costs, as you can see, travel times and travel reliability, those have real effects for businesses as well as residents, the productivity of workers, shippers and logistics costs, emissions costs, safety costs, and road pavement conditions. If the roads are relatively not being used as heavily because of transit alternatives, there's even a savings in terms of the maintenance costs. We worked with the Metropolitan Council to develop costs for each of these scenarios, capital plus operations, all the operating costs through the entire period, 2045, and the maintenance costs of each of these alternatives through 2045. What we did not do and what we did not attempt to measure in this study was any assumption that because of this investment that there would be additional economic growth in the region. There is no effort here to assume that because we make this investment, we're necessarily going to increase our rate of economic development over this period of time. That is assumed to stay constant with the current projections. But one might also imagine that by making this investment, there would be certainly an opportunity for enhanced economic growth in the region. It's just not included in this study. We make no attempt to do that. If you turn to the next page, you'll see the headlines essentially in a tan box. If the 2030 plan is built out, realized by 2030, for an investment that we calculated at $4.3 billion and those are discounted back, we would experience, in fact, a return in the pocketbooks of residents and businesses in the community of between $6.5 and $10 billion for an internal rate of return of 7.8 to 14.8%. If we accelerated the regional plan, you'll see that the price tag is higher. The reason it's higher is not because we're spending more money on the capital portion of the investment. That remains the same. But in fact, we've now added more years of operating and maintenance expense between the time that the lines are complete and 2045, so it's a higher number. But we're also realizing returns and benefits for a longer period of time, and therefore you see $10 billion to $16 billion or an 11 to 18% internal rate of return. And also, we observed that if, in fact, you're able to locate economic development around the stations, you will also see an incremental gain over the first scenario because of the efficiency of both the transit and the transportation system as a result. Makes the transit system even more efficient. You can see on the next page the breakdown of the actual dollar amounts assigned to each of these returns in the base case. Travel time savings and reliability, clearly the largest. Vehicle operating cost savings, second. But each of these meaningful in their own right. I also want to point out something that's not included in the return analysis, which is, in fact, I think, a very important benefit for both employees or those in the workforce as well as employers. Because of this additional transit system build-out, not only would there be new opportunities for using the transit system itself to get to jobs within 30 minutes. And there's numerous examples of people who can imagine, for instance, taking transit to different parts of the metro region, but the amount of transit time that it takes and the changes that it takes is so great that it essentially is unworkable for them. But in addition, because the highway system is now operating more efficiently at particularly the commuting time of the day, we find that the number of working age population, which is accessible to employers within a 30-minute commute, actually increases by 22-25% over this period of time. Essentially, for the employers in the region, this means access to a larger labor pool without having to import additional talent or residents, or gaining access to those who are moving here. And for those who are looking for work, it means a more opportunity to find the right job and the right fit within their region. And I think this is a very interesting and important slide in light of the demographic changes that we can imagine as we look out 10, 20, 30 years, and the competition for talent throughout the country. We want to add as a parenthetically, but it again is not part of our return on investment. There is a $4.3 billion addition in construction impacts. We make no effort to multiply or show the effect of that activity as anything incremental to the original projections, but in fact that is sizable, and 30,000 construction jobs over the period of this build-out. Very quickly, Chair, we also interviewed a number of employers in the community, and you can see the references of the employers at the bottom of page 13 about the importance of transit. And you can see that one of the leading themes is their ability to attract employees. And, of course, that includes not only the younger generation, which is highly mobile and is increasingly choosing transit and other modes of transportation in addition to cars. And in some respects, this is anecdotally, but a good example, when I was growing up, freedom was a car. But for many of the young generation today, freedom is a Wi-Fi hotspot. And for them, and we heard this in Denver when there was a group of us visiting last fall, their attraction to transit is in part the ability to use their smartphone and their Wi-Fi during that commute time rather than being in a car. But these are HR and facility managers' reactions describing why for their employees, and this is a variety of sectors of the market, it's valuable to offer a transit choice. And then on the second page, you can also see that transit permits higher density. This is very important, say, for our downtown hubs. Today, 40% of Minneapolis commuters arrive by transit. There is a fast-growing residential population there, and there are. It is desirable in the view of many businesses and many organizations that want to take advantage of higher density. Transit provides that. But I would say there is a caution also in this last group of comments. Transit must be connected to and aligned with destinations and other modes of transit. In other words, the last quarter mile or half mile of any transit system is key. Are they connected? Is there ease of use or transition? Can you find ways to park and then use a transit? Can you take buses to intersect naturally with light rail or with park and rides? And indeed, do the transit stations themselves allow safe and easy access on the part of the users? The last page is a summary of what I've reviewed in my report, and then I think a few slides of giving some of the background that I alluded to is included. And I'd be happy to take any questions. Chair Dibble?
Thank you, Mr. Coles. That was great. Any questions, members? Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some questions for you regarding some of the baseline assumptions. First, in the last 5 years, we've seen a proliferation, in particularly the metropolitan area here in Minnesota, of telecommuting. That while you've got a clear indication of how Generation X, Y, and upcoming Z, like hotspots and all those types of things, one proliferation that has actually occurred, and I work for a Fortune 100 company, is telecommuting, where most times these people who are working for these companies with good-paying jobs are no longer actually even commuting. How did that factor into this report?
Mr. Coles.
Chair Dibble, thank you. I would say that that was not a factor in this report. Telecommuting, the research that we relied on was on the basis of experiences that have been observed to this point in other cities that have developed transit systems. And I would say telecommuting is a phenomenon that is still emerging in terms of what its effect will be. So I can't clarify how these results might be affected. I think, though, that there is, if you look at what the market is interested in, we find that both the younger generation today prefers some of the more dense urban environments, that they like the ability to be in a highly mobile environment, and we also see that the market for boomers and retirees is growing and being attracted to downtown. So there's a variety of forces at work, and I won't make a prediction about the power of the need for employees to work around one another, but I think that model may change, but I don't want to get outside my realm of expertise.
Mr. Chair,
I
think that's an incredibly large hole in your analysis here and for this particular report, because that is the future. I'm telecommuting right now. I have been. I do here at the Capitol every day. That didn't exist 5 years ago. My client even is going, and my client is in the federal government. They're even actively promoting telecommuting. So I think to wholesale ignore the fact that telecommuting doesn't exist is a monstrous hole in any report.
Senator Osmek, I hope you feel the same way when we discuss roadway investments.
Well, those are potholes. Versus holes in theory and logic.
I don't know how enormous the hole is, but it remains to be seen.
Chair Dibble, I want to make sure. I don't recall, and I would have to research the extent to which trends like telecommuting are included, but I would say that the basis of the research that we relied upon drew upon the most recent trends. And we'll leave it there.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Osmek.
I appreciate that, and that I think it's something to be aware of, because that while the Chair and I may have a bit of a disagreement as far as how large this hole might be, I think it's fairly significant just based on my experience. I just want to point out, go to one other point.
Senator Osmek.
You had indicated, I just want to clarify, you maybe I didn't hear it correctly, you were indicating that economic growth is not described as part of this report. Is that, maybe I'm not here, didn't hear that one correctly.
Mr. Coles.
Chair Dibble. The economic activity of the region is assumed the same in all of these scenarios. That is to say, the Met Council has a projection of population growth, and that is the basis and the behavior of that population, and that trend is assumed to be the same in all of these scenarios.
Mr. Chair.
So, and if I can attempt to restate, there will be economic growth in the metropolitan area, and that's driven by a number of factors, population growth, in migration, et cetera. And we know what that metric is, what's being projected today, you know, based on kind of what we know will be true in the future. This, you know, the various scenarios that were run in this particular study hold those assumptions in terms of population growth and corresponding economic growth constant.
Correct.
There is an argument that then would then go that the return on investment numbers in this report are conservative, because we also know that if we were to be able to build these transit systems and create the amenities and the services that workers are looking for, that employers are looking for, that economic and population growth is in all likelihood to be greater. This is what we hear from Greater MSP, the site selectors who come to this metropolitan area, move on to the next metropolitan area because we don't really have a very interesting, vigorous plan for transit investments right now. Is that a correct restatement?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, perhaps to just restate, and I think I understand what you're saying. I let's say that what you're describing here is you have an economic pie in the metropolitan area. And I think you described this as bending, that you in one scenario you would have the smooth application of economic growth, and that with certain types or certain investments in transportation you would see a quote unquote bending of growth to certain areas. But nonetheless, the same pie exists, at least under your submission here, is that let's say that the pie was $1 billion. Whether the $1 billion is geographically spread over the region versus a focus is put into certain areas where the transportation is taking place, the same $1 billion pie exists, but it's not suddenly not just a $1 million pie, it's a $1.5 billion. That's not the scenario. What your scenario is, it's the same pie. So your numbers here, when you're talking about and the direct impacts, when you're talking about growth near stations, you're just talking about that being an organic growth around the stations, which is economic development that's not taking place perhaps in outer suburbs. You know, if we're talking about light rail as an example, where that growth is not taking place in the outer suburbs, now it's taking place more in the inner cities. But the same economic pie exists. Is that a clear restatement of what this report is actually saying?
Well, I'd say along transit corridors, not inner cities.
I mean, granted.
Yeah, commuter and LRT reaches to the entire region. Mr. Coles.
What is not calculated in our returns is any additional returns due to extra economic growth, other than the behavior that we think would happen if there is relatively higher proportions of growth around the transit corridors and their stations. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, any more questions? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wondering if a task group looked at the IRR based on certain types of projects, whether it be light rail versus bus rapid transit versus lane expansion, what did it ever get down to that level of detail?
Mr. Coles.
Chair Dibble, no, we did not.
Okay.
Senator Pratt.
Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. One other question. As you mentioned, the biggest benefit was in the time savings. Is that a soft return, somehow putting a monetary value on a person's time, or is there a real economic benefit behind that metric?
Mr. Coles.
It is a measure of of the value of labor, that time is monetized as a function of an average wage rate, and it is different whether you're working for a business and the presumed wage rates that's used in that case, or whether you're a resident, in which case it's a fraction of that wage rate. But it's essentially the opportunity cost of being late for work, not getting to a second job, being late to pick up somebody at daycare, and it costs you additional money. It is a U.S. Department of Transportation has developed a very careful analysis of this, and it is a hard labor monetized dollar figure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Carlson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Calls, you mentioned that you hired a consultant, Cambridge Systematics.
And yes,
I'm going to assume that they helped you develop the assumptions and the overall strategy of what you were going to look at. Did they present or have you seen any examples of such project or such planning that did not work, where there was a failure of the performance versus the assumptions when something like this was initiated or taken on?
Mr. Coles.
Chair Dibble, that's a very interesting question. To my knowledge, this is a relatively unique projection of its kind. Typically, projections like this emerge from the funding due diligence process on the part of governmental agencies. And you know, we can look at Hiawatha, for instance, here, and North Star, and the performance of our metro transit system as living in a world of projections and then evaluating that. This is based upon the best analysis, the conclusion that Cambridge Systematic reaches, given the inputs that we designed for them and the basis of the returns that we asked them to focus on, and that they then went out to see what the behavior was nationally among other regions that had made similar investments. This was their highest, this was their correlation, essentially. Now, is it possible that in all those data points that they looked at, that some did not perform this well? Yes, I suppose so. Or were there some that performed much better? I would imagine that to be the case, too. But I think this is a part of what took time in constructing this is that it was we had to simplify the assumptions. We wanted to be very conservative. We wanted to be very clear and be able to translate it to ourselves. And frankly, a lot of research and projections of this kind do not lend themselves to that simple kind of analysis. This is something that they find, the consultants, I think, to be an interesting example of that they would love to do more work in other regions.
And Mr. Coles, I'm sorry, Senator Carlson, are you done?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Coles, I would like to just offer one question then. Is the return on investment, does that include evaluation of risk? Of the risk of the assumptions working?
Mr. Coles.
No. When you ask that question, I'll assume you might be saying, is there a sensitivity range of the possible results? That is not something. I'm sorry, I'd have to go back and look. Frankly, that may well have been part of the work, and I just don't recall as we speak
here. Mr. Coles, I will recall the previous conversation we had in which no wishful thinking was built into the model.
No.
Although it could have been.
Right.
It's a fairly safe assumption that there would be additional growth in metropolitan. This metropolitan area would be more attractive than it would be otherwise, and so more growth than is currently projected by the Met Council would probably occur. So there was some control for that kind of risk, Senator Carlson.
That is true, although it is also true that often in an analysis like this, some range of sensitivity might be considered if for instance, gas prices spiked, there would probably be a much stronger move towards transit than what we have projected here. We're using current pricing, increasing at the rate of inflation, for instance, for gasoline prices. So there are so many variables. I think this is a relatively such a unique, straightforward analysis, conservative, simple in a lot of respects, that there is not a data set to evaluate that question. I think arguably you've also got to look always at internal rate of return as relative to other uses of your capital dollars. So this is not an effort to say that this is the one and only high return opportunity that the legislature, the Senate, your committee is looking at, but it is to suggest that from a business perspective, this rate of return would meet with would be warmly accepted by most business decision makers.
And Mr. Coles, I'm sorry, Senator Carlson, read.
Oh, thank you.
Could you just spend a second telling us who Cambridge Systematics is? Because the reason I ask is because I have some familiarity with them, but in my observations as this report was released publicly, the credential of Cambridge Systematics being present really bolstered its credibility and really got a lot of folks' attention. So why is Cambridge Systematics a good brand? Why is that important that you use them?
Thank you, Chair Debole. I'll give a cursory comment, but I'm going to suggest that perhaps I get that information to you and to the committee in richer form. Itasca Project is staffed by McKinsey Company, which is an international consulting company that has local offices in Minneapolis, and they utilize their networks. We consulted with MnDOT. We consulted with Met Council. We consulted with transportation experts that we knew to get a short list of consultants. Cambridge Systematics was clearly in that very short list. They have offices in a number of locations. I think they're based in Washington, D.C. Certainly the lead on this project came, I believe, from Washington, D.C., Paula Dowell. And we very carefully wanted to make sure that Cambridge Systematics had credibility with MnDOT and with Met Council. In fact, they've had several contracts with the agencies and others here in the state, so they were familiar with us, and they seemed a very good fit, and they came very highly recommended. And I will get you the detail on Cambridge Systematics as well.
Great. Thanks, members. As I understand, I have some familiarity with them, but as I understand, their work is considered to be very strong and very credible. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cowles, one of the things that when I hear the word return on investment, mm-hmm. I usually think of that as you invest $10, you get back $16, you have a 60% return on your investment. But what I see in some of these numbers here is more in the category of what I see benefits, which is travel time savings, versus what I consider return on investment. You put in X number of billions of dollars, and you get back to the original source of the money put in and gets returned to them in some way, shape, or form. So this is not what I see as kind of the classic ROI, but I see pavement maintenance savings in here, which I would think would be more of a true ROI. The other ones I see more as benefits. As a matter of fact, several times it talks about that. So would you address how you calculated some of these things, and did you think of using the ROI on a usual definition?
Well, thank you, Chair Dibble. Thank you, Senator. I think that in the way that we framed this analysis, this meets the test of a return on investment. This is not intended to match the source of funds with to whom those funds accrue. But these are monetized returns. These are not soft benefits in I think the sense that you were thinking. These are in fact savings to real budgets, whether they be business budgets, whether they be residential budgets, tourist visitor budgets, to government agencies charged with public health or with maintaining the roads. These are the impacts which we were advised the research can draw a very strong correlation with the kind of specific investment that we were proposing to be studied.
Senator Kiffmeyer, I think of it similarly as I think of investments in education, or we have, of course, having this big conversation about whether or not we should put more into early childhood education, speaking of Art Rolnick. And how those dollars into early childhood education or K-12 education or the University of Minnesota, what have you, result in more dollars returned than we put in, but the dollars returned are returned in kind of, you know, broader, you know, kind of construed more broadly across our society. So, kids aren't paying necessarily a tuition to go to their K-12 school, and so we're not going to give them a $500 check upon their graduation. But we know intuitively that we do well by kids through education, and now we're learning a lot more about early childhood education, or even, you know, we build roads and we see things happen that are positive that return. Benefits or return on investment. You're absolutely correct. It's kind of an expansion of that idea. I'm just using ROI, not in the discrete sense, you know, our 401k program or something like that. So it is kind of using the term a little more expansively and broadly. But it's becoming a fairly commonly accepted term, in that whole discussion around public expenditures that have, you know, larger returns. That was kind of the conversation we had earlier that I related about Art Rolnick and making sure we were highly disciplined about every dollar we spend publicly, because we are taking that dollar out of the private sector, out of the ability for businesses to spend that dollar. That dollar might be more efficiently spent with a more direct attributable return on the investment. It benefits either the business or the employees or even society more efficiently. We need to be really jealous, guarded, skeptical of every public dollar we spend, because it might not be the most efficient way, but it might be the most efficient way to spend it. And we need to be open to that possibility.
Just, Mr. Chairman, a follow-up on that.
Senator,
might there be some studies about roads in the same format of ROI and the same thing? I mean, I looked at every one of those things, and I thought,
well, I think that's an excellent question, and I think there are some studies and analyses that AASHTO has put forward that show roads built, you know, in a particular fashion, you know, give you a 6-to-1 return on the dollar. Different types of roads and roadway configurations that
you know, and a lot of it relates to land use as well and what the corresponding economic development is. But absolutely, I mean, the AASHTO has those studies. We can pull those out for you. Thank you. Well, Mr. Coles, this was very, very interesting and illuminating and sparked a good discussion. I appreciate your time. Anything further, members, for Mr. Coles? All right. Well, thank you for the presentation. We're going to hear for just a few minutes from Tim Warkey of the Associated General Contractors. He's going to just give a brief highlight of a report known as the TRIP report. TRIP stands for, what is, I'll have him, I can't remember what it stands for. Oh, there we go. Okay. We have some spreadsheets coming around for everyone. That Mr. Warkey will explain
Chairman,
to us.
Committee members.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Warkey.
Good afternoon. Let me introduce myself and for introduction purposes for the committee, my name is Tim Warkey. I represent the Associated General Contractors, AGC. We are a construction trade association of both highway, transit, and commercial builders, and we're the state's largest and oldest construction trade association, first chapter of AGC of America established in 1919. I'm here today to, and I will be brief, respectful of your time. I'm here today to present a study that is not mine. However, it is something that AGC has participated in as a member of TRIP. And I believe, for introduction purposes, let me just frame this up for the committee. Being passed around right now are some data spreadsheets. And I apologize for the volume of that, but really it's for your reference and for illustration. And then there are some maps. And the maps come from the Minnesota Transportation Alliance, but they generally describe the same needs in a visual format that the TRIP report goes into as represented by those spreadsheets. So a lot of things in front of you. I apologize. The report itself is a fairly easy read. It's a narrative format, and I intend to just quickly go through report, and it's great. Technology's working and everything. So TRIP is an acronym for an organization called the Road Information Program. They're a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit. They research, evaluate, and distribute economic and technical data. An important distinction here is that TRIP doesn't generate any of their data. They work with the owners of the data, and I'll get to that on a successive slide here. But they take that data and they aggregate it, and then they tell a story from that data, and they prepare reports across a variety of different topics. It could be a report on congestion. It could be a report on bridge conditions, et cetera. In the interest of full disclosure, TRIP is sponsored by a variety of related industry and business organizations, and AGC of Minnesota is a member of TRIP, as I said. And another important distinction in this study that TRIP does not do is that they do not identify funding sources to address these problems. They leave those decisions to policymakers. They tend to try to focus their reports on the highlight of the issue and the focus of those issues, and then leave those funding determinations to policymakers. So there you can see on the slide the source data. As I mentioned, the most important one is the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Missing from that should have been a slash in the Metropolitan Council for the transit-related elements in this report. But it is all government-generated data. I want to also point out that the data that was used for this report that TRIP put together was also the same database that was used for the governor's TFAC study that you heard about earlier this afternoon. The name of this report, or the focus of this report, is called Minnesota's Transportation Challenges and the Improvements Needed to Address Them. And you can see it's broken down really by four focus areas: pavement condition, bridge deficiencies, congestion, transit. And it is also important to note that the challenges identified in this report are really exclusively on the higher order systems. In this case, highways, MnDOT, the trunk highway system, and then with transit, really the focus is the Twin City metropolitan area transit systems. And we do not get into in this report local government needs across municipal state aid or across the county level systems as well. Just some general observations. In aggregate, the total cost of addressing all of the report challenges that are identified is somewhere between $7.1 to $9.4 billion. And there is an additional identified need of $171 to $181 million annually for transit operating assistance. And the important thing to note here is that there is no identified funding currently available for these needs. No identified funding currently available. The report also looks at some demographic trends. You went into a brief discussion as I was listening about demographic data for the state and for the metropolitan area. Population growth in the metro has increased 21% from 1990 to 2011, and the state's overall population is expected to grow to 6.2 million persons by 2030. And then vehicle miles traveled, another key indicator, has increased 45% from 1990 to 2010, so over the last 20 years. Just briefly on the focus areas, the pavement challenges. For this reporting period, one-third of Minnesota's major highways are in poor or mediocre condition. 12% are poor condition, 9% mediocre. You add those together, you get to one-third of the system in terms of its pavement quality is in poor or mediocre condition. An important point called from the report is that it's critical that roads are fixed before they require major repairs, because reconstructing roads costs approximately four times more than resurfacing them. So the critical component here is get at those problems early while the fix is cheapest, and if you ignore those problems, it will become much more expensive on down the road, if I can use a pun. Bridge challenges has been a big focus and a big concern in this state. In 2011, there was a total of 11% of bridges in Minnesota showing significant deterioration or did not meet current design standards. Again, you aggregate 8% are structurally deficient. 3% of the bridges are rated as functionally obsolete. For folks that are new to these terms, I'm not going to profess to have engineering prowess, but it is not to scare you. It doesn't mean that these bridges are in danger of imminent collapse or of imminent issues. It is a simple way of categorizing what their needs are. Structurally deficient, meaning that there's major deterioration of significant elements, decks or structural elements. And functionally obsolete means that you might have some clearance problems or narrow lanes or those types of issues. So that encapsulates some of the bridge needs. Congestion. Our urban roads are becoming increasingly congested, hampering commuting and commerce while reducing economic opportunity and quality of life in the state. And the report identifies improvements that are needed to relieve congestion and enhance mobility. And those are roughly grouped into some categories: capacity improvements for roadways, reconstruction, and managed lanes, and improved traffic management on multiple roadways in the Twin Cities metro area. If you were paying attention to reports today, you may have seen a media report about the Texas Transportation Institute putting a price tag on the cost of congestion, basically stating $685 per person in cost that we incur sitting in traffic, vehicle repairs, those types of things. Transit, again, focusing exclusively in the Twin Cities metro area. Needs and service reliability gaps identified. There's a need to expand metro mobility, to expand bus service, expand LRT and connect employment centers, add bus rapid transit corridors, And then again, the deficiency in operating funds that would be needed to optimize service along those types of services. The last focus area is safety. And really the principal deficiency in safety is located on the railroad network, non-interstate. And the fatality rate is a measure there that it is triple the rate of fatalities per million vehicle miles of traveled on rural non-interstates than on all other roads and highways in the state. The fatality rate on those rural non-interstate routes is 1.29 per 100 million vehicle miles traveled versus 0.43 per 100 million vehicle miles traveled on other routes. And then you can enhance safety through a variety of techniques, adding cable medium barriers, implementing conflict warning systems, et cetera, on rural intersections, or removing at-grade rail crossings and other types of improvements. The committee talked at length, I think, today about return on investment. This report briefly touches on that more from a broad brush overview standpoint, but categorizes some benefits of transportation in the report on page 7, that improve business competitiveness due to reduced production and distribution costs as a result of increased travel speeds and fewer mobility barriers, reduction in economic losses from vehicle crashes, traffic congestion, vehicle maintenance costs associated with driving on deficient roads, and then also the creation of both short-term and long-term jobs. And if you would indulge me on my last slide, I noticed there was a discussion about some data about studies about ROI and roads and maybe job creation. The job development activity associated with making necessary improvements in both highway breakdown and in transit. A 2007 Federal Highway Administration study found that for every billion invested in highway construction, 27,800 jobs are generated, or for in our case, think of it more, helps me think of it more, is for every $1 million invested, 27.8 jobs. But those are broken down along 9,500 in direct on-site craft construction workers on the job, 4,300 indirect. What are indirect jobs? Those are the jobs that are related to the inputs like concrete pipe and bridge beams and electrical cables, et cetera, et cetera. And then the number of induced jobs, 14,000. Induced jobs are the jobs generated through cycling that money through the economy, the construction worker, the business owner that receives that benefit of that job, then spending that money for durable goods, snowmobiles, ATVs, new vehicle, foodstuffs, whatever. You see the same economics applied to transit investments with a little different result. A billion generates 36,000 jobs. I'm not as familiar with that report, so I can't speak to how that's generated, but you see the same breakdown around direct on-site craft hiring and indirect and induced jobs. And then finally, I think the real ROI equation here being the Federal Highway Administration estimating that each dollar spent on road, highway, and bridge improvements results in an average benefit of $5.20 in the form of reduced elements like vehicle maintenance cost, delays, fuel consumption, improved safety, bridge and road maintenance cost, and reduced emissions as a result of improved traffic flow. So just in general, that's kind of a thumbnail of what this TRIP report is. It was released about 10 days ago here in Minnesota, and I wanted to leave you also again stressing that the information you have in front of you, which are those spreadsheets and illustrated in that map, there is no funding currently identified to take care of those road, bridge, and transit needs. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my remarks. If there's any questions, I can try to answer them, or if they're more related to the detail, I would ask my contemporaries from MnDOT to join me. So.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Werke. Thank you for being so quick. Questions, members? Great. I think we just got these, so that we haven't had a chance yet to put these on the website. Mr. Werke, can these spreadsheets be emailed to
Absolutely.
Us?
Absolutely. I have Great. Files. I can email them over.
Email them to Michael.
Audience or any others, it's on our website at AGC as well, but I will make sure the committee gets full electronic
copy. We promise that all of our handouts are posted on the Scribd website, so we want to make good on that promise. All right, members, anything further? Nope. Thank you very much for your attention. We'll see you Monday. We'll start processing bills, and then we'll hear from the local units of government trade associations. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.